Discover Ag podcast is brought to you by Case IH. Case IH has solutions for every challenge, equipment for every farm. Case IH is built by farmers.
You're listening to a 58 Ember production.
Good morning, Discovering Discos. This week, we discover how France's love for frog legs is causing a potential environmental disaster, how Liquid Death, the canned water company, has duped us all, and how big changes are coming to the grocery store meat aisle and the product of USA meat labeling.
Welcome to Discover Ag, where food meets pop culture. We're your hosts, Natalie and Tara, millennial cattle rancher and dairy farmer, and every Thursday, we go beyond the headlines to discover what's new in the world of food. Can I tell you what I came home to after my off-the-grid camping trip this week?
Ooh, so curious.
No heat in my house whatsoever.
No.
I think when we walked in, our house was 50. And let me just say, like, when you have been living out of a camper, all you want to do is come home to the amenities of home. And when you don't have heat and it's 50 degrees, you're just like, here we go again. Like, plug in the space heater. Let's do it.
So is it resolved now?
Oh, no. No, 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 no. Apparently, like, the whole board thing, I don't know.
I'm surprised you're not more bundled up.
Oh, well, it finally warmed up today. So this weekend was cold outside, so it was pretty bad. Like, our house was really, really cold. But I think now it's, like, 70 outside, so I think it's probably fine.
Huh. Did you guys do anything for St. Patrick's Day?
Oh, so St. Patrick's Day is like a pretty big day in my household because I'm Irish. I'm half Irish. My name, Tara McCrory, that's my middle name, is literally like as Irish as it gets. So normally it's a big day, but this year, Daniel's grandmother had her 89th birthday. So I feel like St. Patrick's Day was put on the back burner and we were all in on the 89-year-old celebration.
Rightfully so.
Totally, totally well-deserved.
Well, I hope all the discos had a wonderful St. Patrick's Day.
I actually have a Proverbs that I was going to read. I read it to you this weekend. Do you remember it? Did you get it?
Yeah.
And I sent it to you? Okay. Okay, here's my Irish Proverbs. May those that love us, and those that don't love us, may God turn their hearts. And if he can't turn their hearts, may he turn their ankles so we will know them by their limping.
Producer Maddie says, amen.
It's a good one. It's a good one.
Is there something that Irish people say to cheers? You know how?
Oh,
is there an Irish word for cheers?
I guess I don't know. I can't think. I just know there's just so many Irish proverbs.
Oh, yeah. They say slánte.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. Well, you learn something new every day.
Cheers in Irish is slánte, which is produced a bit like slánche, meaning health. And if you're feeling brave, you can say slánche is tónche, meaning health and wealth. So there we go. Every week you discover something new. All right. Well, should we dive into our first article?
Let's do it.
All right. First to discover this week, headline, France love for frog legs is causing a potential environmental disaster on the other side of the world. It's time to say non merci to frog legs. So this one was out of our favorite Food and Wine, and it reports how the French love their frog legs, apparently a little too much, as French consumption is putting amphibians in peril.
Are you going to give us our French pronunciation for frog legs? I was really hoping you'd come to the table with that.
No, I backed down. I mean, listen, I just said Irish, and I Googled it actually multiple times and tried to write down how, like, phonetically to say it, and I still couldn't get it right, which is hilarious because I was going to tell you that on my to-do list for this year was to learn another language, and I was going to pick French, and now I'm like second guessing if I have the capabilities to do it.
Were you like, okay, never mind. Nope, this is not happening for me. Here, I have it. Let me play it.
Frog legs.
Oh, that's the English one. Sorry, but guys.
Cuisse de grenouille.
Oh, yeah, no.
It's hard.
Yeah, it's really freaking hard.
It was like, do I remember right? Was it like cuisse gonrea or something? No.
Yeah, but that is absolutely not how it's pronounced. Like, that's how it's spelled, but that's not how it's pronounced. So welcome to Discover Ag, where we also teach you new languages, apparently.
This is the Babbel for podcasts.
Okay, so yes, French are eating too many frog legs. This is actually kind of a wild story, but eating frog legs has been a pastime for hundreds of years in France, and I thought its beginnings were actually really interesting. So it was a few monks from the Catholic Church who decided to classify frog legs as a fish rather than a meat. And so then they were able to consume them during Lent. And since we are in Lent and we have, like, you know, our in-house Catholic girly here, are you going to be, you know, subbing in some frog legs on Friday?
Absolutely not. But if there was any portion of this article that I related to, absolutely, it was this portion, because I was just talking with another friend I have about how on Fridays during Lent, we are absolutely starving. I'm like, I've never been more confused in the kitchen. I don't know what to cook. I don't know what to eat. I just snack all day on random food. And I was like, I get it. If I was a monk too and was searching for something to sustain me every Friday, I probably would have thrown in frog legs too.
I know, I've never gotten that. I don't get the, I mean, I get you're giving up something, but I'm like, you can have fish, like you can have snails, you can have apparently frog legs.
Frog legs. It's torture.
Okay, getting into the actual meat, actually fish, apparently, of the article with the frog legs. There's a lot of FRs in this article. I was really struggling. French diners consume 4,000 tons of frog legs a year, which can be as much as 200 million frogs. So this is no small problem.
Yeah, no, the EU is absolutely dominating in this area. And it's funny because when I first saw 4,700 tons, I didn't think that. I was like, that doesn't seem like a lot. And then they broke it down into the metrics I could understand, which was the millions. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's a lot. So the interesting thing, of that 4,700 tons that goes to the EU, more than 3,000 of those tons goes to France. So France is for sure kind of the largest importer. They're kind of the culprit. They definitely hold the largest consumer of frog legs title.
Yeah, some environmental groups actually presented in front of the French president, Emmanuel Macron, which I feel like is very French. Like, he sounds like he should be Macron. Macron?
Yeah, Macron. Yeah. That's how I'd say Macron. Yeah, like that. You said it like macaroon. You're like, I'm actually hungry. Emmanuel, dessert.
Macaroon. Let's just take a little macaroon over here. Either way, he got a warning that said several species of frogs are actually facing extinction due to the overconsumption of them.
Yes. Yeah, so like you said, there was actually this group of equal part environmental, you know, scientists and actually veterinarians too. They really highlighted that group that came together. There was 500 plus of them, and they wrote this open letter to the French president warning him of this extinction. They said, "Dear Mr. President," quote, "the more than 550 undersigned scientists and veterinarians are concerned about the high level of international trade in frog legs, which has persisted for decades. We call on France as the main consumer to take action to bring this trade under the international control of CITES, CITES, as a minimum step to help conserve wild populations and prevent unsustainable use."
So we are getting these wild populations, sourcing them. I say we, the EU, from Indonesia, Turkey, and Albania. That's where the wild ones are. They're also getting imported ones from Vietnam. But the Vietnam ones actually originate from farms, so they don't have an impact on the wild frog populations. And as I was reading this, I literally was like, why don't we farm frogs? Why don't we just not source from wild and somehow grow and raise our own frogs for consumption?
Yeah, I'm sure that would get into like the whole environmental conversation of what like farming looks like. I mean, that's everyone's complaint when we talk about, I mean, we talked about farming crawfish, we've talked about farming salmon, we've talked about farming shrimp, and it always comes down to like the environmental impacts of farming versus wild caught. I did think this whole, you kind of like glided through the whole suppliers of this, the frog chain, I guess, for lack of better words. And I find it fascinating because 2 points here, and I'm going to circle around to them. But you would think France, for consuming the most, would be, you know, sourcing from themselves, but they're not. It's interesting that in the 80s, France actually put frog on this list. They put it on the CITES list. And so it is currently banned. Commercial frog hunting and farming is banned in France. And so, as you said, they had to start sourcing from Bangladesh and India, but then they put it on the CITES list. And so then after Bangladesh and India stopped, then it moved to Indonesia and Turkey and Vietnam and Albania. And so it was kind of moving from country to country. And this article is saying how, like, obviously there's a canary in the coal mine here. You can see what's going to happen. Like,
Vietnam, Albania, Indonesia, Turkey, they're all going to like wipe through their population too. And they're going to be on the sites list. Like, we're just going to slowly start destroying. And what this made me think of is a couple weeks ago when we talked about overseas, the farmers' protests. And we literally talked about how the EU farmers are upset because the EU imposes regulations on their own farmers and then will import from other places that do what they don't allow. And that's literally what they're doing with frogs. And that was one of the things this letter called them out for. It was like, you're banning this here in France. It's even outlawed. Like, why are you allowing this to take place in other countries and allowing other countries to destroy their wild populations?
Okay. You went on a rampage, which I love. So I'm going to address that. But I'm going to come back to the farming frogs in France. But yes, we must have exchanged notes again in our sleep last night because I put, oh, another case of the EU enforcing laws in the EU and then just importing what they want. Like, it, they continue to do this where it's like they want something they outlaw in their country because, you know, they don't want their wild frog populations affected. And so then they just outsource that damage, that environmental damage to another country. And like, you know, you think about frogs and maybe you don't think about frogs. I personally didn't think about frogs a lot before, you know, researching this article.
Never crossed my mind. Sorry,
never
frogs.
Crossed my mind, but they actually play a really important role in the ecosystem because one of the things they do is eat mosquitoes. And so if they don't eat mosquitoes, like mosquito populations can go crazy. Like it has a big impact that then is like a chain ripple effect of lots of other things. So going back to the farming frogs thing, the first frog farms did start in France within the last decade. So there is like a movement to start actually farming these instead of wild caught, which I'm sure, as you said, will create a whole list of problems. I'm sure restaurants will have, you know, wild caught versus farmed and like, you know, paint the farmed ones to be bad, even though as we've learned, like there's problems with the wild ones too. But it was actually really crazy because frogs have to eat like living insects. And so that's an issue. If you're going to farm something, you need to like bring in food. So the thought of like bringing in live insects apparently is very complicated. I did not dive deep enough on that one. I'm sorry, you guys. But the overall message was bringing in live insects for tons, literally millions of frogs is a big deal. And so they have to breed frogs that would be willing to eat dead insects that are like already packaged, like kind of like pet food, like being able to package up some insects for them. And that is like the big thing that's holding it back from taking off is getting them to be bred. It takes multiple generations until the frogs are willing to eat like prepackaged food, apparently.
There was no part of me at any point of you talking there that I was like, I think I want to be a frog farmer. None of that sounds appealing. I don't want to touch the frogs. I don't want to look at the frogs. I don't want to look at the insects. I don't want to touch the insects. Like, there is no part of Natalie that wants anything to do with frog farming.
I have to ask you, you're a boy mom. Are your boys like really like frog, lizard intense? Like, are they like bringing home all the critters?
Well, that's so funny you asked that because when I was thinking this, I was like, hello, France, just come to my yard. There are frogs. Like in the summer, there are frogs everywhere. We do not have a problem with population control here. We can start exporting from Natalie's ranch to France if you need it because we have frogs everywhere. I mean, I'll mow and I swear I probably run over a few frogs every time I mow. And yes, the boys love them. They love to chase them around. They love to play with them. Thank goodness they've never brought any in the house because I don't do amphibians. I don't do reptiles. I've never touched a frog and I don't know how much money you'd have to pay me to do it. It's not me, not for me. Have you ever tried frog? I feel like you randomly probably would have come across it and tried it.
I know. I knew you were going to ask me this. I was like, shoot, I'm going to get asked. I don't think I have. Like, I'm pretty sure I haven't. And so I was like, I know you said you won't be trying it for Lent, but I was like, okay, I'll add it to the list of things I need to try.
I'll take one for the team and try the frog legs.
So the next time I'm in France, don't worry. It's top of my list.
One of the articles said that it tastes like chicken and then... Well, actually, they said the texture is compared to chicken wings and structure is similar, but the taste depends on how you prepare it. So like if you're, you know, sauteing it, battering it, etc. But then I read another article that was like, yes, most people compare frog legs to taste and look like chicken, but we would say it's a soggier version, as if chicken had been blended with fish. And I was like,
Ooh. That sounds appealing. You don't like chicken and you're not like a huge seafood goer either.
That was, I'm like, you couldn't come up with a better way to describe soggy fish. Oh my goodness. So yeah, I will absolutely let you take one for the team and you can be the designated frog leg trier.
Maddie's weighing in. Producer Maddie said, I have. Tara would like it. So, okay.
Oh my gosh. Okay. If we have any discos that have, please message us. Let us know your experience. Let us know where you were at. I'm so curious where in the US. It's probably obviously like coastal or something that is, you know, offering this up as a menu dish.
We need to get some of our EU discos weighing in on if they're eating frog legs. So, okay. Well, next time we're someplace that has them, I'll do it.
All right, you guys, moving into our second article to discover this week, headline, Of Course America Fell for Liquid Death. So this was out of Apple News, and it poses the question how a company that sells canned water is worth $1.4 billion. And then obviously it dives into the details of it all, which I found so fascinating as a budding entrepreneur. But before we kick it off and dive into it, I want to take a second and just properly explain liquid death, because I think there's maybe discos tuning in that are unfamiliar with it. So liquid death is water, but it is water in a can. So it's this brand, right? And think like tall boy size, think energy drink. Like it looks like an energy drink. It has the vibes of an energy drink. Like the liquid death logo is actually a melting skull. So it's kind of like this. Again, think energy drink, but water in the can. Okay. And that's what it is.
Or even like an alcoholic beverage in a can. Like it's definitely giving, like, you're not sure exactly what it is. All it is water. And some of the water is flavored. There are some other options, but I will second double down on what Natalie said. Fascinating article. I knew Natalie would love it because literally this brand is a $1.4 billion with a B dollar brand. And it's all because of how they branded water. Mm-hmm. Nothing else. That's it. And the first time I actually came across Liquid Death was just about a year ago when we were at the Dear Media event in Austin. They had Liquid Death as their water, which felt very like on par. Like I was like, yep. That entire event was like absolutely branded like crazy. And so it would make sense that whatever water they picked would also be like some, you know, crazy brand. And that was really my first introduction to it. And I remember picking up the can and being like, where is their water? Because it was hot in Austin that weekend. And being like, I don't want like an energy drink or a beer. Like I really was not sure. And then I was like, oh, it's water, because their tagline says murder your thirst. And it literally says on there water. And so you're like, oh, okay, I guess this is the most intense water I've just ever drank.
So that's interesting you say that, because, well, there's so many things I want to double click on that. But my first experience was also like an event. I feel like they really kind of came into the scene through like concerts, events where people wanted to have water, just like your experience. But you don't want to be, you obviously aren't bringing it yourself to a concert, and like a water bottle isn't like fitting of the vibe, right? Like you kind of want to match the energy and the environment around you. And I feel like that's what's so genius about, you know, this CEO. But I feel like he recognized that need, that gap in the marketplace for people who are in a certain type of environment. Like I'm not going to be drinking Liquid Death at home, you know, or I'm not probably not going to be taking it on like a road trip or something. But there's absolutely a major need for it in these settings where you want water, but you can't be drinking it like casually. Like it needs to be upscaled. And it just dialed in on that. And I'm not even surprised that it's a 1.4 million brand. I was honestly kind of shocked it wasn't higher.
I completely agree with the idea of like what it looks like in your hand. Like at a concert, then you feel a part of it. I bought some after that event. I bought a few for like on our boat at the lake. They are pretty pricey, so I did it like twice. But I will say, like, if you're like out on the lake and everyone's having a beer and you just want to have water, like it is one of those things that then you're just like, I don't know, you feel like you're like in the club, but you're just drinking water and it feels like you're hardcore and cool. Like I'm a cool mom, not a regular mom. I drink Liquid Death. Like,
yeah, I mean, the last concert I was at, they had bottled water instead. And I definitely felt, which is weird because you know me, like I don't have an issue being with people and not drinking. Like it does not bother me. I do not get peer pressure into it. It does not bother me at all to be the only one in the group not drinking. But it was weird to like stand in the middle of this concert with like a bottled water. Like I felt out of place, like having the experience before of being able to have water in a can at multiple concerts and then being put in one where I was like, had the bottled water. I missed my Liquid Death. I was like, why don't they have Liquid Death here?
Yeah. And I feel like in today's world, we have more people who are like sober curious or going sober. You think like dry January is huge. And I feel like this very much fit a niche. There was actually a quote that I loved. It said, what other industry produces billions in revenue selling something that almost everyone in America can basically get for free? It was like branding. So well branded. That's it.
Yeah. So I want to dive in that. We'll get into marketing because that I feel like that's how they got to, you know, be so big. They have genius marketing. But one thing I think is really interesting is you just highlighted how they were talking about like capitalizing off bottled water and being a part of the bottled water industry. But I thought it was so fascinating how this article pointed out that Liquid Death is not essentially a water company. What they're selling is the can, right? So they're selling it two parts. You already mentioned once that their claim is like, well, you said death to thirst, but to pair with that, one of their quotes or claims like marketing is death to plastic. So they really target people like it's better to have the can than the plastic. And then also the actual, as I mentioned before, and we've talked about multiple times, like the experience of having the can. So they're not even selling water. Like you're buying their product for the metal, like the can. And I think that is so fascinating.
Yeah, it's a brand that happens to also sell water.
Yeah.
To put their size into perspective, at $1.4 billion, that would make it 1/10 the size of the entire no and low alcohol beverage industry. So it has 10% of the entire no and low alcohol beverage industry.
That's yeah, and they doubled. So in they quoted what they were valued at in 2022, and it was half of what they're valued at now. Like that's how rapidly they're growing.
So a little bit about the CEO. He actually spent a lot of years in advertising and he wanted to do some really crazy, cool advertising campaigns. And he really quickly realized if he wanted to do what he wanted with advertising and not have like a different CEO turning down his ideas, he had to create his own brand. And he went all in on this.
Yeah, I'm so fascinated by him. It's actually on my to-do list to listen to a podcast that he's guesting on because I just want to get in his mind so badly. But getting into the marketing of it, we already talked about, so he actually launched this 5 years ago, 2019. So again, owning, we talked about how they own 10%, how they're already, you know, billion dollar brand. That's all in 5 years. So keep that in perspective as well. On social media, they are the third most followed beverage behind only Red Bull and Monster. They have 2.9 million followers. I spent so far too long this morning scrolling through their marketing on social media and it was genius. I mean, it definitely hits, like it's not for everyone, but it definitely hits their target audience and it obviously works for them.
Yeah, and it's beyond just the water. I mean, their like merch line is also amazing. I mean, t-shirts, hoodies, beach chairs, watches, signs, trading cards. Like they are boxer briefs, like tons of different things that like support this. It's almost like a lifestyle choice. Like I drink Liquid Death.
Yeah, he said it is. He's building a brand. He said, because the brand is what's most important. The brand is all that's there. He told Washington Post last year that it is all marketing and brand because the reason people choose things is 98% of the time rational or is 98% of the time is not rational. It's emotional. And it goes back to when you shared that he spent so much time in marketing. I am not even shocked that that's his background, like that he truly understood going into launching this brand. Let's build it on the back of building it a brand around our people.
So he actually saw a concert goer drinking Monster Energy. And that is when he had the idea. Like he saw someone that was drinking that to stay hydrated. And he was like, why has no one marketed water in this same way? And that was like it. That was the spark for the entire brand.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes so much. Like I said, he just recognized an amazing gap in the marketplace. And it fills it. Like he does such a good job.
Yeah, they actually did a ad in the Super Bowl in 2022, and it was like a parody of advertisements for alcoholic beverages, but it was like children enjoying Liquid Death, and then the advertisement ends with like the tagline that says, don't be scared, it's just water. So they obviously like, even that, like you're getting a very intense reaction if you see a Super Bowl commercial where it looks like children are drinking beer, and then to end with, it's okay, it's just water, like genius.
Well, there are two of the reels at the most top of their feed. One of them was a young girl that said, I'm pranking my dad at 8 a.m. by chugging a beer or making him thinking I'm like shotgunning a beer. And I'm like, I want to do that so bad with Luke and the guys out at the like you know,
just after a really chore beer. Like, I'm just going all in. I'm going to just party hard today. Like, you can't, what's the saying? You can't be drunk all day if you don't, or you can't drink all day if you start in the morning. Like, just like go out ready to go.
I think it'd be sort of like, hey, you want one? Toss a couple and then like just like pop mine, like rip it back and just like chug it and see what they say. So I that might be on my to-do list for content creation.
Oh my gosh, we should do this. Discos, let's start a trend where we prank people with liquid death. I need to see this everywhere.
And then the second one of their top reels was they gave it to a grandma at like, I don't know, it looked like they were at like a family dinner and they were like, drink this. It's called liquid death. And she's like, no, it says liquid death. I'm not drinking that because it is kind of confusing. I remember being at a concert with, well, and like the same, I was with you when we were at that event in Austin where people who are first time exposed to it are kind of confused by it. But then once you get it, you get it.
Absolutely. So some things about the water, actually, that I maybe only me that is like a kind of a water geek, but it's actually 100% mountain water from the Alps. So they like, I feel like they also tried to do water right, like make it, you know, it's not just like purified tap water, like say Dasani or something is. Like it is supposed to be, I mean, yes, it's just water, don't get me wrong, but they tried to also do like a premium water in their can. But I honestly want to tell them, like, I feel like your fans are going to drink it no matter what. You could probably just be purified tap water and it'd be all right.
It's like out of our garden hoses. Listen, we're going to start selling frogs. We're going to be slinging frogs to France and, you know, putting our hose water into cans and selling that as well. The last thing I'll say that I think, again, why I'm so fascinated with this CEO and what I think he did well is he started with the water and has since branched out into different things. So they have introduced iced tea and seltzer and they stick with their brand. Like it's the Dead Billionaire, the Bury It Alive, the Mango Chainsaw. They've also added sparkling water flavors now. There's the Squeeze to Death, which is orange, the Cherry Obituary. And then they have a Grapefruit, which I want to try so badly because it's the non-alcoholic Paloma. And I love a Paloma. So they've also, the last thing they added was also a Death Dust, which is electrolyte packets that you add to water. And I just think they were so smart about how they started with one thing, unrolled others to kind of pair, hit the same target audience, and then also kept it like branded around the whole same like vibe and brand. Like they're genius. Like Discos, give it, you know, 5 stars, you guys.
All of their, not all of them, but a lot of them, like you said, is like a non-alcoholic Paloma. So the Death to Billionaire is a non-alcoholic Arnold Palmer. Mm-hmm. So if you have a drink you like, you can find your non-alcoholic flavor of Liquid Death, which I think, like you said, is just really genius and really cool.
Yeah. So look for it. I'll have to see. I don't know if I've seen it in our small town grocery stores, and I've never looked for it. I'll have to look for it the next time I venture into the big city and see like where we can get it, where I can get it here in Nebraska.
Now we are all looking for help to get us through cold and flu season. Is anyone else sick and tired of being sick and tired and just overall not feeling and looking our best? Well, how about a product that helps boost our immune system plus improves hair and skin radiance? Armora is a proprietary concentration of bovine colostrum that harnesses over 400 living bioactive nutrients that rebuilds the barriers of your body and fuel cellular health for a host of research-backed health benefits, including strengthening your immunity, igniting metabolism and anti-inflammation, fortifying gut health, activating hair growth and skin radiance, powering fitness performance and recovery, and conferring powerful anti-aging benefits. That all sounds pretty great, right? Well, it's all Armra. Natalie and I have been using and loving Armra for several months now. We have our whole families hooked too. Both Natalie and I prefer the non-flavored. I like to take it straight every morning or mix it in my girls' chocolate milk. But if we had to choose a flavor, we would recommend a watermelon vine. If you want to try Armra for yourself, go to tryarmra.com/discover or enter code DISCOVER to get yourself 15% off your first order. Again, that's tryarmra.com or click the link in our show notes and enter code DISCOVER to save some money. Did you know that in today's market, wine producers are not required to put additives on their wine labels? So much more can go into that bottle of wine than just grapes. But if you are looking for a fabulous glass of wine that has nothing but grapes, look no further than Enchantment Vineyards. This vineyard and winery is located right here in New Mexico. Owned and operated by two sisters, Enchantment Vineyards produces about 30,000 bottles of wine a year, producing Chardonnay, Crimson Cabernet, and so many more choices. But Enchantment Vineyards knows that great wine is from great grapes, not additives. So when you drink Enchantment wine, you know there is nothing in that bottle except grapes. So much care and attention goes into growing and harvesting the grapes. Everything they put into the bottle is hand harvested. You can order a case of Enchantment wines today and have it shipped directly to your house. All you have to do is click the link in our show notes and use code DISCOVER20 to save 20% off your next order. Again, click the link in our show notes and use code DISCOVER20 to save 20% off your order.
All right, diving into the last and final article to discover this week, you guys. Biden administration finalizes higher standard for product of USA meat label. I saw an article that said, Q, born in the USA, the song. I thought that was so funny. Just setting the mood, you guys. We're going to set the mood, okay?
Oh, man, I had a total miss on my reel I did for this on the Discover page. I should have done born in the USA.
Yes. Oh, my gosh, you did. Missed opportunity. Okay, so on Monday, a rule was finalized requiring meat, poultry, or eggs labeled as a USA product to come from animals born, raised, slaughtered, and processed in the country. So it was announced by USA Department of Agriculture Secretary Vilsack at the annual meeting in the National Farmers Union in Scottsdale, Arizona. He said, quote, "This final rule will ensure that when consumers see product of USA, they can trust the authenticity of that label and know that every step involved from birth to processing was done here in America."
I want to back up a tiny bit because we went off of one article, but we also were on the USDA website where it's like the actual official information. And I thought one thing that was interesting is the article you said just said a rule requiring, but this is actually still voluntary. But if you're going to use the voluntary label, it has to meet these requirements. So it is not mandatory to use the label, but there's new requirements if you're going to use it.
Yeah, I think it's actually, I can't believe this is coming out of my mouth, but kind of genius and smart the way they did this. So we have covered this before, not this article, obviously, but kind of this topic, this theme.
Yeah, because it's been going on for years and years.
Yeah,
it's like, and we talked about it, every single administration's like, I'm going to tackle this. Then they tackle it, it gets rolled back. Then the next administration says they're going to tackle it, it gets rolled back. So yeah, we covered it like a year plus ago.
Yeah, and part of the problem why, whenever we talked about this historically, I would always say, I just don't think this is ever going to get passed because it always breached on NAFTA. So, you know, North American Trade Agreement. And it's just kind of complex and overwhelming, which we can get into. Like, if you know the beef industry, it just seems really overwhelming of how you would monitor a mandation like this. And so the words out of my mouth were always like, yeah, something needs to be fixed, but don't really know how to fix it. And I don't know if this is like the answer and that we'll ever get to this place.
Before you keep going, I do want to say it does not go into effect until 2026. So a piece of me is like, what will happen in the next 2 years that will somehow roll this back? Not to like be Debbie Downer, but I just feel like a lot can happen, including an entire election between now and 2026.
So that's interesting because when I was talking about my husband with this, we were talking about how I don't know if this is going to be as big as people think it's going to be. I said earlier that it's kind of genius or strategic the way they did this, because I feel like it kind of shuts up and appeases, like, I know that sounds terrible, but it really does appease both sides. So historically coming into this, there were the camps that said, this is like asinine. It's crazy that we have labeling that says product of the USA when it's not product of the USA. Like, this has to be changed. We have to, you know, like, this is crazy, right? And on the opposite side of the camp, there were people who would be coming to the conversation and saying, like, we don't want more government mandations. We don't want more government control. We don't want more government outreach, basically all anti-government. And then also, like, you know, physically, what does this look like to for producers to, you know, partake in this? What's the cost, the employment? Like, you know, they always came from it like on that conversation. And I feel like this appeases both of them because it stops the crazy labeling system we had before, which
it was crazy that you could have product of the USA labeled on something that wasn't. So it removes your ability to do that. And then it gives the people who are worried about the control, the extra steps, you know, that are like, I don't want to be involved in this. They don't have to be because it's voluntary. So I can't believe I'm saying this, but I think it was kind of well done. And so I don't know if it will get rolled back. I know it's 2 more years to your point, but because it's not mandatory, I don't know. I feel like it will be implemented, but I don't think it'll take off in the way that people think it will.
Okay, so many things. I feel like we're going to end up, this is going to be a longer article, so buckle up and hang on with us. But a few things. The rule was proposed last March, and there was a quote that said, this is seen as a big win for us ranchers. And I will say, it is mixed reviews. If you go on the Discover Ag podcast Instagram page and go to our reel about this, you can go in the comment section, and there is ranchers and farmers that have varying viewpoints across the board about how they feel about this. And so I don't know that it's just like a seen as a slam dunk. But one comment that I did see that it made a really good point was, people that want product of the USA have the option to buy directly from farmers and ranchers if they wanted to. Like, we know direct to consumer business is like a big business nowadays, especially like post pandemic. There are so many cattle ranchers that are selling direct. And then second, at the opposite end of the spectrum is the person like maybe going through the drive through and getting like a burger or like a combo burrito. Do they really care if it is a product of the US? Like, are they truly like willing to spend their dollar and invest in that? And I just thought that was a good point on this person was not necessarily for or against it. They were just kind of making the point that like, do we need this extra labeling? At the same time, I agree with you. I think the label as it was, where you could put product of the USA and the animal would be born, raised in another country, was insane.
No, I mean, I think that person is actually my viewpoints exactly. I mean, one thing you and I will say over and over and over again on this podcast is food choice. And so when I see people get super upset that this is happening, which again, it's not so much that I disagreed with people getting upset that the USA label was on a product that wasn't USA. It was that maybe I didn't agree with the people that were saying like, this needs to be mandated as a label, because like you just highlighted, if you care that much about sourcing your food, it's not like you don't have the option to shop direct from farmers and ranchers. We already know it's easier than ever, except for when you were actually raising the cow yourself. That was the last time it was the easiest to ever shop locally. But now, like, you can Google, get online, and there are direct-to-consumer beef businesses everywhere. And the person that doesn't care about that, because, you know, now you're changing, as you mentioned, their, you know, what's important to their household is economic, right? It isn't the label. And so now that mandation would change how much they have to spend. And for me, I feel like this goes back to why I actually like, again, how this is kind of rolled out, because I feel like this gets to actually see if consumers will put their money where their mouth is. Because I guarantee you, if there is packer price incentive, packers will do it. So if this partakes, you know, this rolls out, we fast forward 2 years, 2026 comes along and the label goes out there and people start actually buying it because they know it's USA and they want to support USA and they are paying that premium, the packers are going to do it. The packers are going to, they'll do whatever makes them money. If the consumers don't put their money where their mouth is and don't pay for that label, the packers won't. And so this finally gives us a chance to say, are Americans willing to pay more for money? For years, you've been saying you want to, and now comes the time to prove it. So prove it to us. And as US ranchers, we will figure out how to support that. Like, we will make it happen in the supply chain to support that. But now we get to put it to the test to see.
Maddie's in the comments. Natalie for president 2024. Get on your campaign trail, Natalie. We're ready for you.
Well, it's just, I mean, this, I could bring up so many points about this, but I was researching because I wanted to. This is one of the things that comes down to me is the price. Are consumers willing to actually pay for it? I cannot believe, I'm sure you've seen it, but every time I see it, I just am floored at the percentage we as Americans put of our income to food. It is the lowest of any country worldwide. The last agriculture census in 2012 put it at around like 6%. Then they rolled out another one since, and I took a screenshot of it. We're below 10%. Switzerland, Austria, United Kingdom, Canada, Singapore, France, Japan, Brazil, every single other country pays more for food than us. And yet, how many times, Tara, have you and I been searching for articles to cover on Discover Podcast, and we found articles complaining about food prices, inflation, and grocery store? Americans always want to bitch about the food, but they never want to pay for it. I'm sorry, but that's how I feel. Like, we don't want to pay more for food.
No, it's absolutely so true. It is also a thing where once you start paying for something at a less price, it's really hard to like absolutely. Convince yourself. Like, it's just like, you know, you're like, oh, if I make $100 more per paycheck or whatever, you're like, I'll save that. And you don't. You end up like spending it, right? Like, your money, like, once it's allocated somewhere, it's allocated somewhere. So to start paying more for food is going to have to be a very, very like active choice and decision. And I think that goes back to that very first point that like those people are already sourcing meat from where they want to source it because they're willing to pay for it. The thing is I believe packers will make money off this. And one of the comments though was how many like hoops and things are producers and ranchers going to have to jump through to like get, you know, passed for this and then not actually see the dollar at the end. Like, the packers are going to make money on this, and chances are the rancher is actually not going to, is something I have a big fear of.
Well, I don't know about that, because I think this will be contracts, right? So I think this will be and this is why I go back to what I said at the beginning, that I don't think this will actually take off. Like, it won't be a major thing. I think it'll be a really good avenue opportunity for the right size of feedlot to work with the right size of cow-calf operation, because I think what will have to happen is the feedlot will have to say to the packer, okay, you're interested in doing this. I want a contracted price. Like, I will bring you the, you know, 10,000, 100,000 head, whatever it is. I'll bring you those head that are in this, enrolled in this program, but it's going to be contracted at this price. And then that feedlot will turn around and the cow-calf guy will then have to be like, okay, I'll do this. I'll go through all the extra hoops to get certified and do whatever I need to do on the ranch to follow this program. But it's going to be an extra $5, $10 head, whatever it is. So I think there's actually going to be contracts in place, which is why I don't think this will be a huge thing that takes over, you know, the US and every single ranch and farm does it. I think it'll be the right size people that, again, if the consumer is willing to pay for it, you'll find the ranches and the feedlots that are willing to do the work for the return on investment to supply to the packers. It all comes down to, I know we say it all the time, but it really comes down to consumers voting with their dollar.
Okay, I'm going to take us in a totally different direction. You say you don't think it'll get rolled back. Mexico is already not happy.
They I know.
Angry about this.
They are
Mexico
not.
Mexico exported $3 billion of beef, live cattle, and derivatives to the United States last year. And what is insane to me is the reason this got rolled back in 2012, as you said, was the World Trade Organization sided with Mexico and Canada and said it was like unfair to them for United States to have a product of origin label. That's asinine to me. Like, I don't understand this part of it at all. We have product of origin labels on all fruits and vegetables. Like, tons of products have where things came from. We covered the fact that Mexico had a Super Bowl ad claiming, like, buy Mexico avocados. And their argument was that, like, by putting a product of the U.S. label on it, we were saying our product is, like, superior to their product. How in the world is that different than marketing Mexico avocados as like really good avocados compared to like Florida's avocados? Like, I do not understand that.
And that's a common argument we've heard from everyone, right? Like, if we can label and market other food, like, why can't we do it with the meat? And it's just, I mean, we've said it before, but the beef industry is so segmented. It's just a little bit different shipping a whole avocado to the US than it is like a cow. Because I saw another comment that was talking about, this is going to get into all like importation, exportation, but like one of my soapboxes is there is so much misinformation around our importation of beef and exportation of beef. People love to say like, we're taking our high quality beef and we're shipping it, you know, we're exporting it overseas and then we're bringing in all this crap so we can eat all the crap. We make really good high quality beef. Okay. We should be proud of this. We export it to like China, Japan, because they're willing to pay a premium for good quality cuts. We're also exporting nose to tail, right? So we're exporting a lot of organs. Tongue, tail, like, I don't know, all the things that we don't want to eat. Okay, Americans, you don't want to export that. Learn to eat it, right? The other thing people don't understand is that a lot of what we import, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, is lean trimmings to meld with our beef because people want a leaner ground beef. Okay, so I think there's a lot of confusion around the importation and exportation of like, you know, Mexico and that whole conversation of like what it looks like to bring in. And going back to like, again, we put it on an avocado. Well, we're bringing in the lean trimmings from Brazil to meld with our ground beef here. Like, it's not, it's just a little bit more complicated. I get it. I get the argument of like labeling other food, why we can't do meat. But again, it's just like the beef industry is segmented and it's just a little bit more complicated.
Yeah, there's a Disco comment actually about the trimmings as well that I found fascinating. And this is such a good point that this is where the sectors of agriculture are so different. Like, I, as you're talking, we both have cattle. I'm dairy, you're beef. And this is like another part where beef and dairy are so different that even me as a person who owns cattle is like, I don't understand like that single piece of the beef, you know, production cycle, because I'm in a completely unrelated sector, right? Like, dairy has so many, like, we already have to have like traceability all the way from birth to beyond, where like, you know, on cattle ranches, it's like different. Like, I saw a lot of comments that were like, well, you know, producers or cattle ranchers are now going to have to track all these other things. And I was like, yeah, we already do that in dairy. But again, yeah, it's so different, just like avocado is different. So while in my mind, I know I'm like kind of a consumer on this, and I'm like, it's simple, just put a label on it. It's not that simple. And that's actually one of my last comments that I had was like, I know that in my mind, I'm like, put a product of the US label on it. That makes sense. It's easy. And I'm like, it's not that simple. There's no way it's that simple, or it would have already been done.
Right. Which is why I like, again, I'm like fairly, I mean, if I was going to address this labeling fiasco, which is what we essentially have, like, we, to start with, we have a labeling fiasco. If you can put product of the USA on something that's not a product of the USA, it's a fiasco. Like, it's terrible. So if we're going to try and fix it, the best first step isn't mandatory, which is what always has been tried to push through, is a mandatory labeling, right? I feel like the best first steps are to remove packers' ability to place the label on, which this is what this rule does. So no longer, if you see that sticker, it's no longer confusing, you know. And then if packers want to figure out a way to pay for it, the enrollment, and put the product out there, they can. And if they don't, if there's not the price incentive, if consumers won't buy it or pay for it at the end of the day, then we don't have to put the label on it, you know? So the no label is an option, and the label proving it is an option. I feel like, again, I go back to my original statement. I feel like it's kind of a win-win for everyone. The best win-win we could get out of this. Except for our Canada discos. They're like, you guys, we have good beef, and you are like, because I do think Canada has really good beef, and they're part of the, like, North America, Canada, and Mexico is part of like that NAFTA trade that, like, I'm like, I know, I'm sorry. Like, I support, you know, Disco Canadian beef. I think you guys probably raise it, as you know, as well as America does. And so, like, I know you're getting lumped in and kind of like the short end of the stick.
But the last thing that I will say that is completely not even really about this is this entire USDA announcement also came with the announcement that the USDA is going to be doing $9.5 million in grants for 42 projects expanding small scale local meat processing capacities. And I feel like that's being overlooked. And I actually am pretty excited about that. I know, as you know, our town has a little tiny meat processing. I hope more towns get small meat processing facilities. And so while $9.5 million seems kind of small for 42 projects, personally, it's still something. And so I feel like I'm kind of sad that that's not, you know, making more headlines, because I feel like when the pandemic hit, we were in an uproar of like, why is there not more places to process meat? And now the USDA is like actively trying to do something about it. And so I was happy about this part of the announcement as well.
No, I agree. It is a good start. It does seem like a really small amount, you know.
Super tiny. $9 million like, is like not a lot of money in this day and age for a processing facility.
No, not at all. But that is one of the big issues. Like, when people talk about like, well, how can we fix, you know, again, problems we have in the meat supply chain with like the monopoly of the big packers, it comes down to more processing facilities and like infrastructure, you know, the ability to put one up to support it financially. So I do think that that was like a smart area to invest money. Again, if we're going to look at like fixing some of the things that are wrong with the beef industry, it's a good start.
All right. Well, with that, I feel like this is such a hot topic. It's obviously gone back and forth so many times. So we want to hear your opinions. We know you guys will show up in our Instagram DMs, but please do give us your thoughts, opinions. Where did you agree with us? Where did we, you know, get it wrong in your eyes? We'd love to hear from you. Otherwise, we will see you guys next Tuesday for a Hot Off the Press personal episode.
This has been a 58 Ember production. For more shows, please visit the 58 Ember channel, 58ember.com, or find us at 58 Ember Media on socials.